Okay, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation to talk here. I'm very honored to be here to discuss with such a great group of scholars and also to engage in such important topics. And I have to underline that I'm here really to learn with you and hopefully bring some contribution to the field. And my topic, I take a bit different topic as Nando, so I will talk about social media. And there are first two points I want to underline before I proceed. So first, my work concerns mostly media, particularly social media, and such focus may seem to come to these issues a bit around the corner, but as we all know, media today are central in the way we understand and engage with society, and therefore raising questions of race and power through media seem timely and relevant, particularly now as the media environment has changed rapidly and digitalization has provided new means of sharing, reshaping, and circulating information. So this talk will be not so much about introducing my research as it is an attempt to think about the situation we are and how we got here. Secondly, being a white, middle-class, middle-aged woman, I may not be the right person to address issues of race and power, at least challenge the issues of race and power. But perhaps my position here reflects the Finnish academia. The questions of race and the research of racialization, ethnicity, is done predominantly by white people and predominantly by white women, people like me, with good intentions and with the aim towards more just society. But of course, there are limitations to what I can reach with these questions and the way I understand, for example, what constitutes racism. And this goes, of course, back to Donna Haraway's situated knowledge and beyond. So this is something we need to acknowledge in order to move forward, and I'll come back to these questions in the end of the talk. So with these stipulations, let us begin. This talk proceeds in three parts, and it's built on to follow a certain timeline. First, I discuss the relevance of social media in the early 2000s and understanding of how media engagements were thought to be relevant to understanding of race and racialization, and also the possibilities to possibilities for voice in our political climate. Second, I focus on how the emerging practices and technologies of social media are played out in the intensifying political climate and in the rise of anti-immigrant movement, but also in the emergence of new voices in public and how they are shaped by the contested space of social media. And third part attempts to build some sort of ideas of solidarity in the current situation. And my talk is also located predominantly in the context of Finland, as we think it's really important to think about this right now. So focus on media brings out the relevance of the ability to take part in political debates and discussions on social justice, an ability that the most vulnerable are often deprived of. Ruth Wodak and Nick Stevenson, among others, have pointed out how in contemporary Europe the rights of refugees are increasingly weakened. And if we consider that ability to take part in the political debate is fundamental to justice, when these possibilities are taken away, people have no access to the membership of society, and they can be closed off and treated as non-people. And this does not only refer to refugees, it includes all members of society who are, for some reason, marginalized. Therefore, having access to public debate is crucial for human rights. But it is far from simple. We may think that now with social media participation, the public debate is available for all. However, there are many problems attached to that idea. Social media is not equal, it is not free, and it's limited by many social, political, and technological elements, shaping who gets to speak. And then there is the question, of course, is anyone listening? And these come to around questions of voice, or rather voicings, as Radhika Gajala uses the term voicings, that are produced in these diverse contexts, and these conditions shape how we can speak and how the speech gets heard. So I try to investigate what implications the emergence of voicings might have for the existing and emerging structures of power and racialization. So this is to underline that I'm discussing voice as a matter of justice, and also voice connected particularly to experience as a source of knowledge. So, in the early days of social media, participation was seen as a promise of new equal and democratic world. Also, ideas of race and ethnicity were seen to become irrelevant. They were utopias of the cyber world as a space of freedom and equality. These ideas went something like this: we can step into the cyber world and become raceless, genderless, anyone we like. We can cross distances and move beyond material restrictions of body and place. So according to this idea, we leave the materiality of our bodies and social lives behind and stepped into the cyber reality where none of those materialities bind us. As we know, it didn't work out quite this way. In my research throughout the years, I have seen that what people want from and how they engage is the opposite. Social media is preoccupied with questions of race, gender, questions of identity. Ideas of race never disappeared. As Laurie Kendall contends, gendered, race, and class identities continue to have salience in online interactions. And Lisa Nakamura argues that while many scholars have noted the democratic and empowering effects of participatory media upon media for users, media can also operate as a powerful vector for distributing racializing discourses that also reflect the concerns of an online culture obsessed with determining identity online through virtual profiling, for example. So what does this mean? Almost 10 years ago, I conducted a research among immigrant youth with, as an ethnography in a local Finnish school, giving media classes, discussing use of media. I interviewed the young who also made media diaries and organized documentary workshop with them. In this research, I learned how relevant social media was for identity work, for forming and joining groups with existing local social relations, but also exceeding them to join various diasporic, ethnic, gendered online communities. For many, online communities operated as a space for socializing, popular meeting place to hang out, but also as a space of activism and, importantly, expressing racialized experiences as a way to reclaim race through own profiles and groups. In other words, social media was and is an important forum to voice experience when you're living in a society with white privilege. What came through from the interviews was a sense of natural culture that couldn't really address these issues. So social media was the place to do that. At the same time, social media was not completely controlled by Facebook, Instagram, or Snapchat. There was a IRC gallery, IRC gallery, predecessor of Facebook, as national social media and meeting place for the young. Already, we could see here the architectural elements and dynamics that shape digital space and have become fundamental characteristics of social media communication. The gallery and I call it residual network, as it seems to be fading away while still sort of persisting in a way. In this space, we can see the formation of diasporic and transnational groups and profiles that express identity often through multiple layers of cross-memberships as multilingual and mobile. Since a gallery was for the young and for hanging out, for dating, for expressing sexuality, it was overtly playful and ironic, but at the same time contested space of expressing ideas and politics of identity. During that time, in the research in Nordic countries, we discussed very little about race and racialization. We talked about ethnicity, and Topias was probably one of the few who insisted talking about race at the time. And we perhaps with this downplayed the relevance of racialization or didn't know how to engage it. But obviously it was there in many forms. So on social media sites, people can attach different things to their profiles, as we all know, their favorite music, fashion, ideas, and most importantly, groups, naming groups that seem to be an important avenue to politics of identity. So all these different groups were expressing identity and belonging and sense of being belonging to a certain race or expressing pride over that. And there were several different kinds. These are just a few examples. The racial imagery, if I use the concept by Richard Dyer, seemed to be multiple and often playful and celebratory. And there were also many groups voicing clear stance against racism, several sites of expressing transnational solidarity or solidarity against racism. Yet there were other political undertones within these engagements that revealed struggles over racial imagery and struggles over politics of race that are apparent in a, what I call a kind of construction of white spaces or extreme white spaces. So these were created through groups named as Love Your Race, where members were named Honestly Racist, Skinhead, or Soldier of Freedom. This extreme whiteness was distributed to different areas of life, from fashion to music, in music profiles connected with white power music, in fashion to different kind of clothing styles and boots, with different specific slogans for the groups, as a complete lifestyle. So ideologies of racial superiority of whiteness were connected to these groups, flagged through slogans, performed on profile pictures, as construction of, as I said, extreme whiteness. But if we think what Richard Dyer in his book White, how he talks about whiteness, his goal in his work was raising of whites as a way to dislodge us from the powerful position of being just human, representing all humanity, undercutting that authority. And he writes, we need to see whiteness, its power, its limitness, put it in its place and end its rule. We white people rarely see our white privilege in white cultures such as Finland, except when it's not the only horizon or identity available, perhaps. So while whiteness appears in society as the invisible norm, here in the gallery sites, whiteness was expressed visible and extreme, accented, manifest, not as typical, but as an ideal that speaks and is built on the ideology of racial hierarchy. It proposes a structure of feeling that sews together a certain type of cruelty and superiority. Yet here is the double bind. Extreme whiteness is, of course, dependent on the invisible norm, and it relies on that. But on this side, the presence of extreme white spaces did not go without notice or reactions, of course. In terms of voice, different strategies were applied to make a point, something that we may see as performative voice or effective voice. So In one of the groups called Skinheads of Finland, there is one non-white profile that belongs to what appears to be a black young man in the image who claims membership to such groups as Born to be White, Thank God I'm White. This obviously confused the other members. Angry comments beneath his profile image tell him to go back to Africa or state belief of his brashness to claim these groups. He can't possibly be part of this group. Most likely, although not necessarily, this is a counteract within the social network site to ridicule, confuse, and tarnish the white supremacy movement, a troll. It can be also a result of cyberbullying. Nevertheless, the appearance of that profile claiming the space from the white supremacy group spoils the sense of shared white community and the coherence of the movement. So while this is an individual example, it is an example of the politics of race on social media. And often, as we know, it is effective by nature. It disturbs and it creates a presence of uncertainty. While this is also an example motivated by anti-racism to ridicule extreme whiteness, similar, more hostile attacks were made by white extremist groups and are made by white extremist groups of racialized youth and done through occupying, trolling, harassing, and hoaxing identities and affiliations. So this was going on all the time and from one group to another, one site to another, in different tools available with the social media. So it is important to understand that while mechanisms may be the same, the values underlining these actions are drastically different. It is a different thing to use parody for revealing racist or sexist thinking than use irony for strengthening those ideologies. So all this politics of race on social media use sites around 10 years ago was struggle over the space, and it was invisible in public culture that hardly engaged issues of racialization or white power or normative whiteness for that matter. But what we can see here is the sort of seeds of current political climate. Now, years later, both political climate and media environment have changed in ways that have consequences to how we engage public debates, how we may be activists, but also how we may make use of our presence in ways that we don't even always be aware of, that also carries significance to processes of racialization. So, as we all know, extreme right-wing groups and anti-immigrant movement have become increasingly powerful in Europe and elsewhere, also by using digital media in different ways. In Finland, the anti-immigrant movement has actively and quite successfully entered and influenced the national politics, making use of this kind of politics of irony. An effective practice of ironic detachment. It is irony that denies certainties. It can mock, ridicule, exclude, embarrass, humiliate with playful coldness by not taking things seriously, evading responsibility, using trolls and memes, by circulating false and harmful information. It is irony that is cold and uncaring. This sentiment echoes and travels to political attempts to create white nations and exclude others on islands and camps. It is white irony and deeply racial politics. The effective practice of irony makes use, of course, the networked structure of social media. So it also appears on Reddit, 4chan, Ylilauta, spilling from hate sphere to manosphere or the other way around. It uses playfulness and humor. It becomes mixed with different kinds of imageries of sexism and racism and becomes difficult to tackle. During the refugee crisis, we've seen proliferation of imageries and memes referring to different ideas racialized ideas. For example, the racialization of rape is something that we all identify. And different kinds of counter discourses of racism, denial of racism and reverse racism have been circulated through these memes, which I don't want to share here. However, there are also technological structures and dynamics that take part of this politics of irony, sort of assemblage and coalition that are created and enhanced by technology. How technology makes algorithmic clustering of different kinds of groups and keeps them together. We know this, we talk about bubbles, but they are more also very much within the technologies in ways that we may not always understand that. And of course, they are kind of suggestions that are made in a similar ways as one buys a book from Amazon or a dress online, something that you might be interested in. So you get suggested or technologically aligned to these different racialized groups. And linking, this is how technologies, digital technologies form racial coalitions, and social media operates as a kind of technology of race at the same time. And it is important to understand that the ways in which internet governance enables circulation of hostile content, as it is also relevant part of the business model based on the immaterial labor of users, platforms such as Facebook, Google, are reluctant to regulate their contents. Instead, they rely on self and peer regulation and often outsource moderation from local to global contexts. Defining themselves as IT companies that facilitate space for people to participate, profit is made from the contents by collecting data and selling user data to advertisers and others. And this is also the element of so-called hybrid media system, where forms of older and newer media operate simultaneously in a kind of concurrent process of integration and fragmentation. It challenges power through new practices that grow on the edges of existing institutions. These changes shape political debates with new kind of networks, non-elite and non-professional media actors and relations. This can be both productive and non-productive. But when this effective circulation of hateful and racist content becomes profitable for particular platforms such as Facebook, we can talk about platform racism. As some scholars have investigated recently, for example, Ariadna Matamoros and Seta Gangadharan. But recently, some small steps are taken. There has been more pressure towards platforms to remove and ban, for example, racist and Nazi contents. For example, in Germany. In the US, there is, for the first time for years, there is a kind of sense that now something might be happening. There might be ways to actually regulate Facebook and create this kind of environment where people might be able to pursue towards that. But the problem still remains. So far, I have tried to show that voicings that draw on experience of different kinds are produced in diverse online contents and shaped by different political practices of irony that are also enhanced by technologies and economics of social media. And through the network structure of online media, connect these practices and sensibilities to other contexts and networks. While I have focused on the negative sides and problems, there are also, as I said, it can be also productive. There are important positive developments. For the past three, four, five years, particularly during the refugee crisis, new voices have entered the public sphere, mainly through blogs and activist media, some of them as political presence, expressing what it means to be racialized and what it means to live in this society with immigrant background, and to point out the white privilege in Finland. It is noteworthy that these sites emerge predominantly outside the mainstream media that seems to be more or less incapable of identifying the multicultural Finnish society, or at least produce any kind of voice for that. By intersecting the public and private, these blocks exemplify the emergence of a more intimate, effective, agonistic publics as forms of political action in digital era. So blogs such as Ruskeat Tytöt, started by Koko Hubara in 2015, has put in the words the importance of experience for voice in her book. She writes that one has to talk from the experience when there is nothing else, no words, no public debate, no literature. Experiences and emotions are our reason, our theory. And I think in many ways social media has been able to create or open that space, at least to some extent. There are also investigative non-profit activist media that has emerged to question the standpoint of neutral reporting of refugee crisis by mainstream media. The Migrant Tales blog started already in 2007, but which became more visible in 2015. Has invested maltreatment of asylum seekers in reception centers and provided evidence of these cases to public. Migrant Tales has been able to cover a series of stories on the conditions of asylum seekers and deportations. Since many of the writers also are immigrants themselves, there is a certain base for community of shared worldview and trust connected with the experience and also the recognition of white privilege. And this kind of sense of reciprocity and shared concerns is more generally characteristic of an alternative and radical media that I think these blogs exemplify. And not only in terms of topics, but also in practices with often open, non-hierarchical, transparent media organization, drawing on collectivity and sharing, often multilingual in publishing, and stories from different locations. And in this way, it is also rooted in experience with community to speak to and speak with. Voices from experience were also heard in the campaign during the refugee crisis, Once I Was a Refugee, where Ennen Olin Pakolainen, where former refugees used their own voice and body to raise sentiments of solidarity. In this case, social media express and recreate value to refugee lives that are rendered useless, waste, or burden to the global north. Thus, the campaign proposes the right to be seen in own terms and the right to represent self-images in ways that are not necessarily connected with typical images of refugees. These are images of labor, education, and value. And in this way, the images create self-worth against physical, social, emotional marginalization in the society. And they can be seen as images of hope. In addition to these, many other solidarity campaigns and groups have been organized through social media across Europe. Refugees Welcome, Refugees Hospitality Club, The Right to Live, among others, as new visible expressions of solidarity. For these movements, social media operate primarily as a tool for organizing action, providing shelter, food, utilities, organizing, mobilizing demonstrations. Yet, in the contested political climate, such blogs, activist media, individual activists are obvious targets of hateful and racist attacks. And this has shaped activism from open towards more closed action. This has been development in other areas of activism, particularly in feminist activism. It has led to strategies of private and closed groups as safe spaces, caution and self-censoring in case of attacks, formation of new sites when the ones that are used are hijacked or attacked. Activists who I have interviewed who operate actively on social media agree that attacks have intensified during these past years. Increasing amounts of digital labor is also used to manage attacks, secure spaces, verify sources, reveal fake profiles and information, and also as a kind of new skills that have to be learned in order to be able to act. So forms of public and hidden activism are part of the struggle over digital public space, and this struggle has become something that preoccupies, dominates, and exhausts people engaged. And it may also sometimes direct the movement altogether. What is noteworthy also that the multicultural groups encountered on IR IRC Gallery 10 years ago are now, many of them moved to Facebook, but not as open groups anymore. They are closed groups. They are safe spaces that are needed in order to be able to operate and create as a form of counter-public. So what I want to say here is that while we see the emergence of new voices, voices from the experience who tell about experiences of racialization and what it means to live in this country, there are more and more difficulties also, or increased intensive attacks towards these voices. And this dynamic has existed a long time, and this is what I sort of tried to explain. It has been there already in different forms, but now we have seen it become more intensified and also enhanced by the commercialized technological structures of the hybrid media system. But when we think about the situation, I think we need to also realize that the struggle against this sort of extremism and extreme whiteness, we may fall into the trap of seeing the extreme whiteness as the only problem, and forget that the invisible whiteness, the neutral everyday whiteness as a norm, has not disappeared anywhere, and that it operates as a springboard to extreme whiteness. So this is the question I want to pose. How do we build solidarities in this situation? Most interest in solidarity in academic literature is in the field of political theory, trying to understand tensions on the conditions of solidarity, whether it should be connected to group identity or sense of shared humanity, promoted through self-realization or sense of justice. Postcolonial studies, cultural studies, critical geography, feminist and queer studies have paid attention to solidarity, particularly in terms of political struggle. Feminist authors such as Chandra Mohanty, Jody Dean, Lauren Perlant, for example, come to the concept from different directions, often pointing out the tension between universalist ideas of social solidarity and the recognition of difference, critical to essentialist ideas of humanity. I find it important to bring these discussions together to expand and challenge the narrative of we, and to find new ways to understand solidarity in an increasingly contested, complex world. This is not something I should do by myself, but I invite you to think about this with me. These discussions are timely as ever in the world where rights for citizenship and human protection, some might say even the understanding of humanity itself, are redefined. So one way to unpack this is to problematize the ways in which emotions and affect drive solidarity. For example, by differentiating between solidarity of compassion and solidarity of dissonance. Both of these may be mobilized through digital media in different ways, as we know, but they operate very differently in terms of the notion we. Solidarity and humanitarian movements particularly have been criticized for naive sentimentality and universalism. We may identify this in many other movements that seek to alleviate suffering or help as a form of feel-good activism, where someone like me, a middle-aged white woman, may feel herself a better person by helping others, not recognizing at all her privileged position, assuming false sense of similarity with asylum seekers, deported or suffering. Such false similarity can also be part of the struggle against the far right, where white activists assume position of victims, not actually recognizing the double bind of normative and extreme whiteness. However, Chandra Mohandi, Jody Dean, and Claire Hemmings, among others, root their understanding of solidarity in disagreement and dissonance. Dissonance for them offers relevant freedom from ideas of we as unity. Dissonance compared to compassion is more promising, as it arises from experience and recognition of difference. It is driven by emotion that does not seek closure, but accepts difference and proposes feeling of dissonance as seed for reflexive knowledge. Yet it is not trapped in the idea of difference and confined by it. This is also the concern that's been raised by Paul Gilroy, who wants to talk about rather indifferent difference as not to build walls around identity. This view underlines that differences allows us to explain the connections more accurately and to theorize universal concerns more fully. Mohandi argues that experiential anchored in the lives of marginalized communities allows us for a more concrete and expansive vision of universal justice. Her position is not to say that all marginalized would automatically provide for more authentic knowledge of power and equality. Quite simply, she argues that if we form our understanding of just society on the basis of the experience of the privileged, we are not likely to recognize those structures that further inequalities. Whereas if we think from the space of some of the most marginalized, we are most likely to envision a just and democratic society capable of treating its citizens fairly. Therefore, this idea importantly connects together the ideas of voice, experience, and justice. What would this look like then? It would mean collaboration, participation, dialogue, and listening, as suggested by these scholars. There are many examples of these. However, the current environment does not encourage necessarily toward such solidarity. And I think at the moment where we are now, this is the challenge that we all face, and we need to take it seriously. Thank you.